something that we definitely wanted to address was mental health. And I'm very curious what your perception of other students' mental health is. It seems like you were in a very isolated community where a lot of people weren't talking to people as much or trusting people. You know, my community was definitely more close-knit, but it was very normal for me to know just how much everybody's mental health was suffering from the student population. I probably knew more people who were suicidal than not, at least passively. Self-harm was very common. Right before concerts was common, like in the, like not even in their rooms, like in the student bathrooms.
That's the thing. That's what I was just thinking about, the bathroom. There were professors that had told me that like they knew about it. They were like conscious that in the women's bathroom on the music level floor, like there would just be like a little like couch space, but they eventually cut that out. But that's what happened. People would go in the bathroom after lessons, after being told to quit and that they were horrible.
Yes.
When they would cut themselves, they would cry. Like you just knew. Like that was just,
I was shocked.
They didn't report anything. They didn't do anything. Like technically they're supposed to too, as mandated reporters. Like you are supposed to report that, but they were just like, oh, well, they're cutting
it's
them.
So common. If they reported every time they knew about it, we'd have the FBI. That's what I think. Like I think about like if everyone that I knew who had attempted suicide or been like about to, or who had made a plan had been successful in school, there would be a national investigation. It would have been seen as like, and just the fact that most people either, you know, didn't ultimately go through with it or weren't successful, people could sweep it under the rug. But I heard all kinds of horror stories, and we did end up losing people. You know, we lost somebody who I studied with, who I really respected, not to like hugely get into that, but I do wonder like, you know, and obviously there are other factors when people make that decision. I'm sure for a lot of people, it wasn't just the conservatory culture, but I definitely know it didn't help. And it got to the point where like oftentimes we have, you know, we do evaluations for individual classes, but we would also get emails about like like anonymous surveys about the school in general. And the last like 2 years that I was in school, every time we got those, they were like, you know, called like the president's survey or something. I would write that there was an epidemic of passive suicidal ideation and mental health crises in the music program over and over again. Cause I kept thinking like, if somebody reads this, they're going to do something. No, never mentioned, never brought up, nothing ever done. And it did deeply, deeply disturb me. It's very triggering, you know, to know that like, okay, you walk into the bathrooms on 7 or 9 at any given time, someone might be self-harming. I had a friend who developed a habit of every time she made a mistake while practicing, she would punch herself in the jaw. And it's almost like a nervous tic. It was like an instinct. And, you know, I was somebody who was trying really hard not to fall into these negative patterns, some of which I had, you know, had from childhood. And then this was the time when I was supposed to be away from the things that triggered those. And then I'm in this community where people are just flagrantly, like openly dealing with all of this because there is nowhere to put that energy. There's no time for it. You know, you always think like, well, why wouldn't they at least wait to be in private? There isn't time. The instinct.
Rehearsal after lesson, then yeah, never.
Yeah. I think people feel like they have to put that somewhere. And I always wondered because people knew about it. People obviously knew, you know, oh, we just had dress rehearsal. And then suddenly the girl comes back in a sweater, you know, come on guys. Like, you know, like, and nobody cared. And I just wonder, was it just too big? Were people just too overwhelmed with it? I guess I guess that's what it was, is people just didn't want to touch it. And I don't know if that was always because they were cruel, although for some people, I'm sure it was. I think for a lot of people, even in positions of authority, they were afraid.
Why were they afraid to not say anything? That's the question. They should have been more afraid to have not said something, because technically, I don't know how everything works, but I do know that they are mandated reporters. So technically, as soon as they hear about something like that, they should not be reporting the student saying, oh, the student, take them away. No, they should be, oh, this is happening. I'm hearing this, that this is happening with multiple students. What can we do to make it better? And no one did anything. And I think that sends a message to the students that place, and also the ones that aren't in that place of, okay, well, if these people in these positions of power are saying it's okay, then it must be okay. We must just have to deal with it. And that's the interesting thing, that as instrumentalists, I'll tell you from my perspective of what I had seen, is we don't talk about it because that ruins your name, and you want to appear being perfectly fine so you can get gigs. All of a sudden somebody is not there, and I would like ask, like, oh, where's this person? And someone say, oh, they took a semester leave. And me, I would always like try to reach out and be like, what's going on? And I would reach out to like particular people, like, hey, I heard that you took a semester leave, everything okay? And it was some sort of mental health issue, but nobody ever wanted to. And of course you want your own privacy, but everyone was so afraid to speak about what was going on or why. And so it's just people just like dropping occasionally, like not there, but then they would like resurface and then they were back as if like nothing happened. Yeah. It's not that they needed a break from everything and just needed extra time. No, they needed a break from music school. They needed a break from the conservatory. They needed to leave there and then go.
Oh, I thought about it all the time.
Yeah. So it's not necessarily that, and I'm just talking about certain situations. Maybe there are others that this was different, but a lot of them were like working way extra hours, like working a job and stuff. They're like, I just need to get away from that school. And yeah. And it was just something like you just don't talk about it. And
yeah,
I think I've had enough of that clearly, because I'm so abused now we're talking about it, but
yeah,
of everything. Yeah.
I think a lot of the people in positions of power see it as like this giant Jenga tower. And they're worried that like, if they address one thing, they'll pull out a block and the whole thing will come crumbling down. And I think there's some truth to that. They address, you know, the self-hatred, the competitiveness. They're also going to get into the verbal abuse. And if they get into the verbal abuse, they have to get into the sexual abuse. And if they get into that, like, it's just going to get bigger and bigger. And I think they think like, we don't have the time. We don't have the money. We don't have the resources to fix all of these problems. And I can empathize with that, but also, do you have a choice? Like, I don't think you do. And I don't want to see anyone else get hurt. I had one student who I was newer friends with. I had just started getting to be comfortable around. And all the teachers jumped at the fact that I was friends with them, because they were like, oh, finally, this person really needs a friend. And I took piano. I had what was called Section 80 piano. I took piano one-on-one because I had already had piano experience. So I didn't really work in a classroom setting because my levels for things were in all different levels. I went to my piano lesson and my professor was like, hey, are you friends with this person? And I was like, yeah. And they go, can I ask you, are they suicidal? And I knew this person had a lot of issues with their mental health, as did we all. And I was like, I don't know how to answer that. And, you know, before I even said anything, he goes, well, their behavior has been really, really disturbing to me. And I feel like I need to file a report for the student being really disrespectful. But also their behavior reminds me of somebody I knew who did kill themselves. And so I just want to know if this report is going to be the thing that sends them over the edge, because I have to do something about the behavior. I'm just not sure if they need help or if they, and I just remember feeling so trapped by that situation, because if I say, yes, their mental health is suffering, they may be suicidal, then this professor may report that. On top of the fact that it is not, like, I didn't feel like it was my right to answer that question on somebody else's behalf. I didn't feel like that was safe. But if I didn't say that, then the student was going to get in trouble from a behavioral standpoint. And so I remember I tried to be as vague as possible. And I tried to say, you know, I can't answer the personal stuff, but I do think that the student just really needs to see somebody have faith in them and kind of break the ice a little bit. And then they will, you know, these behavioral things are a defense mechanism that will fall away eventually. And so I was like, I would just encourage you, instead of taking the like aggressive action, to give this person another chance, because if their mental health is suffering, you can't go wrong with that. So I kept it as vague as I possibly could. He took that as a no, they're not. And then he went and reported them. and they had like a whole big thing where they had to go before like whatever you're like, it's like a little trial that you have to do. And I just remember I was so angry that I skipped my next two lessons because I could not be in the room one-on-one with that professor. I felt so betrayed that I had to have such a personal conversation about another student behind their back, and that I felt like the information I gave was misused in order to fit that professor's agenda. And that ate me up inside.
Yeah, how wrong is that? Like, I mean, being a music ed major too, like I'm already taught that you do not go to another student. It doesn't matter if they're a minor or if they're just barely an adult with not a fully developed brain yet. It doesn't matter. You're, as a teacher, you're not supposed to go to another student about another student's mental health. Like that is-
They did all the time.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, it's wrong at so many levels. Like how do they get away with it? It's because people enable it. And
were there comments on students' bodies and appearances as much when you were in school?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, yes, I know about some of that. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean, I can say that, yeah, there was a professor that made fun of a student for being really ugly, like facially wise. And then when that student stopped wearing glasses, the professor started saying to me, not to that student, saying, oh my God, they look even uglier now, and like making jokes about, yeah. So that was a thing. And yeah, there were comments about weight. There were comments about, from professors, comments about students' weight, comments about what they wore. If somebody, like a student that was born male at birth and was dressing in a more stereotypically feminine manner, that would be talked about too by professors. There were instances too where there were students that wore like a little bit of like a lower cut shirt, and a professor had said that it's okay for thinner women to wear stuff like that, but not women that are heavier, because then it shows more. I don't know where the logic is in that, but that was that. So yeah, there are professors that, yeah, making comments, and
yeah,
not just comments about like bodies generally, but like sexualized comments.
Students' bodies.
And some were made straight to students' faces. Others were made to other students about those students.
Yeah.
And it's also like, then when it happens, you're terrified because you know that report, if you say something, then you're labeled a whistleblower. And then you just came over for jobs or in the school, or, and then that professor that has power over you, over your grade or whatever, then you know what's coming for you if they find out you reported what they said. So yeah, a lot. I will say that a lot of comments about.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the voice department sort of gets away with it because they tell themselves that, like, well, your appearance is part of your casting and your body is part of your instrument. So if you're overweight or underweight, we need to talk about it because that, you know, your health affects your performance. So there's a lot of comfort with that. And a lot of it is like, well, because you're being looked at more so than an instrumentalist to some capacity, because you're acting, you're playing a character. You know, there's this, I think they kid themselves a lot. Something I got was, I always got that I was too pale.
What does that have to do with anything? Like, I don't understand why they brought that.
They'd say I looked blue on stage, and I did look blue on stage, but I think they should try to light me better. They'd be like, oh, you're so pale. Like, and I'd be like, face, arm, same color. I don't know what you want me to do. Like, I'm not going to get a spray tan for a performance. I'm not going to waste $40 on a bottle of foundation that turns me orange. Just like, you know, and I would compromise. I tried to put as much like blush on as I could, but yeah, that was dyed hair. Dyed hair was a big thing. It was selective. It kind of depended on how well the student was liked. I knew a student who was, you know, non-binary and was treated like, because they wore suits to perform, even though they looked more stereotypically feminine in their day-to-day life, that allowing them to wear suits to perform was this incredibly gracious thing. So therefore they don't have the right to advocate for themselves for anything else. And one of those things was dyed hair. So the student had to get a wig, which of course school's not gonna pay for that. And so, you know, but because they could afford a cheap wig, it was a cheap wig and it looked like a cheap wig. And then the whole faculty was like, well, that looks even worse. And, you know, I volunteered. I was like, I'll help. I can make it look better. But that's where I'm like, did I contribute to the system? Because yeah, I styled the wig and I made it look more natural and I, you know, did what I could to help. But the whole time I was like, I don't feel good about this. I feel like who is that shocked by, like, it's not that distracting anymore. I feel like half the people I see on the street have unnaturally colored hair. I can't imagine having my focus pulled watching a choir or an orchestra and seeing somebody with different colored hair. It's not any more distracting than somebody with natural blonde hair or natural red hair. Like, it's just we have to get over this, guys. And you know, the dress code too was, you know, being told, a lot of people were told, like, oh, well, that might be fine for somebody else's body, but with your body type, you can't wear that. I remember the line that was used was, you know, we'd always be told, like, oh, you know, when you're above the audience is, you know, on the floor, is below you, so they can see up your skirts. I have never actually experienced that. I've realized, like, wait, no, you actually can't. But we would be told that. And the line that they would use was, the moment when the audience thinks they're about to see something is just as bad as actually seeing something. that was the line. So it was like, there was a uniform. Everybody was obsessed with wearing tights. Like, yeah, there was a lot of comfort in talking about students' bodies, personal styles. And it was rough because it's an artistic field. You have artistic people who oftentimes have a lot of ways of personally expressing themselves, but it was constantly like, not like that.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I guess something that was said to violinists and violists was to, like, if, and I feel like a lot of people have this, but like when you, your arm here, and if you have like any bit of like a jiggle here, which even, I mean, I don't have a lot, but I do have a little bit of that, you're supposed to hide. But you're not allowed to wear shirts like this or a dress that doesn't have sleeves on it if you can have a jiggle, because it's distracting to the audience. And I remember being told that, and I was like, what? And like, I think I said something too. I was like, if I was seeing an audience, I wouldn't be distracted by their body. I'd be listening to the music. And it was just like, no, you want to cover that up. And so I remember at the time that I started doing like more, I didn't really work out too much. I wasn't into it. I didn't really have to either. I was just like, I don't really want to. Okay. I started doing just arm workouts, particularly for that, because I was like, okay, I'm being told to do this and I'm a violinist, so I must do it. Because then I became like self-conscious. I'm like, oh my God, I do have like a little bit of a wiggle. Or I saw it when I was recording myself practicing and I looked, and I remember
having how skin works.
Yeah. I had like a panic response. I'm like, uh-oh, like I want to be able to wear shirts or dresses that are like this, you know, to show my shoulders. Also, it's more comfortable on the violin. Yeah. To not have a full sleeve, because then the violin slides. I'm like, uh-oh, I got to work on that. And it's like, oh my God, no, like I never should have. And it's like, I never even noticed that until it was pointed out to me. And then if I would see somebody else playing and I noticed it, like, I'd be like, uh-oh. And then I'm like, but why do I think that way now? Like that was just taught to me. And now I have to work to train myself to not think that way. And it's all that we're taught it. We're taught.
No, I know. I'm always really, you know, when a singer breathes, I can look 3 months pregnant. Like, you know, you're expanding. I'm never going to have like washboard stomach, because that's not how those muscles are developed to be helpful to me personally. And so there was there were comments about stomachs being distracting. I remember when I was auditioning for college, my audition coach saw a photo of me in the horrendously matronly and ugly dress that she told me to buy to wear for auditions. I did not. The day of, I had a panic attack and just pulled a velvet black skater dress out of my closet and wore that instead, because it felt like me. But I remember that, like, I sent her the photo in the dressing room and she's like, that's great. But you need to get some Spanx. Even thin girls need Spanx. And I did look and I was like, yeah, my stomach, it's not completely flat in the dress. I was 110 pounds soaking wet back then. I'm 5'6". I was a skinny little, you know, 18-year-old auditioning for college. And she was like, oh no, you need Spanx. And so I bought my first pair of Spanx. There weren't even Spanx small enough to hold me in at the time in the store. Not a problem I have quite so much anymore, but at the time, like, yeah. And I just remember being like, really? Is this my body is doing its job? And then the obsession with cleavage too, when half the time, if you're performing an opera, you're wearing a corset. And when you breathe, your boobs are up to your chin anyway. So why do they care so much? You know, you go to Europe and they want you to perform topless too. So there's like this massive double standard between like being extremely conservative and being artistic and edgy. And it's like, how do you win? How do you negotiate all of this?
You can never be right. You can never win. Mm-mm. That's what culture is, conservatory culture, classical music culture is. Yeah, you're always wrong. Before we get into other people's stories, because we've talked about quite a bit of negative stuff, I want to bring some highlights, I guess, to some positive stuff. I think Claire has quite a few. I have just a very little tiny bit of good experiences to talk about. And they're small, but I think they're just, it shows that there is, like, the bad stuff can't happen without the good stuff. There is good stuff as well. But, you know, something that we do is that we have a studio class Monday nights is something that my teacher does. And it's totally extra. Like, she's not required to do it, but she does it every week, unless there's something that pops up of the semester. And it's always in the evenings. And there are times that she had brought, like, these really special, like, fruits and, like, chocolates that happened towards the end of the year. But I heard that before the pandemic, studio classes used to be at the teacher's apartment. Now they're at school, but they used to be at their apartment. And my teacher would, like, make dinner and, like, make all these nice foods and stuff for the students. I just think that that's so sweet. I've had one experience, sort of a chamber music party. I guess I can't really say this was part of my experience, but chamber music parties are a really cool thing. I know that these were things that used to happen to, like, my teachers. So, like, their age, they used to always have chamber music parties. That was just, like, a thing. And I guess that's another thing that I expected when I got to conservatory was that, yeah, that's what happens. You guys have chamber music parties. And I wasn't interested in the other types of parties where they drank or did drugs. I'm like, man, not my thing. No, I want to do chamber music parties. I guess another thing that I really liked, particularly my first year and then my second year, I guess, is that in our theory and piano classes, they were very close-knit. So the way that things kind of lined up was you had four theory classes and four piano classes. So oftentimes, if you started right at the beginning, you were with those same people in theory one and piano one, and then theory two and piano two, and it just kind of went up that way. So we had kind of a close-knit class, and maybe, I don't know if it was just our class, but, like, I would write, like, music jokes I came up with on the board, and then it would kind of spark discussion. And it was really fun to, like, create these jokes when I knew, like, the class really loved them. So that was something that was, I think, really fun for our classes. And it kind of, like, brought us a little bit more together and, like, tried to push away, like, the make connections only sort of thing. And it started to foster friendship, but it could never really truly foster in that place.
Yeah.
Yeah, those are my limited happy experiences.
Yeah, no, there were definitely some. I remember that at the end of our first semester when I was a freshman, before, like, my entire freshman class dropped out, we did Secret Santa for each other, everyone who lived in the dorms, and we all went into, like, our common room in the dorms and exchanged our Secret Santa gifts. And they were all, like, humor-based. I remember I have stupidly small hands, like, I can't play an octave on the piano, and everyone thought that was very funny. So somebody, my Secret Santa bought me child's gloves, and everyone thought that was very funny. And then we all went around the room and we gave every single person gave a compliment to every single person, like, in a circle. And it felt, now, did I get that any other semesters? No, but that was very needed, especially because so many people didn't come back after that. The backstage culture during tech weeks, you know, during opera performance weeks and everything, I love the backstage culture. I always did the makeup and hair. I designed it for all the undergrad operas. And I loved those few weeks leading up to it, of figuring out how are things going to go? What do I need to help with? What can I teach other people to do for themselves? You know, I would get there hours early. I would set up in the green room at, like, 3 p.m. when call time was, like, 5 or six. And I would just sit back there, and anyone who could come early, I'd get started on their hair. And I had some of the best conversations with people, even people that I didn't necessarily always get along with or wasn't super close with. Like, tech week, anything would fall away. Everybody was in such a focused mentality. I always felt so proud of my colleagues in those moments. I have friendships that are still important to me. I think a lot of it's a trauma bond. If you do end up making friends, there's your trauma bonded. And also, just, you know, even for people who I didn't go to school with, just like with you, it was easy to connect with you because we had so much common ground to begin with. We could relate to this culture. So to me, it's like, if I see somebody else who's a music student who survived music school, or who attempted to survive music school, or who went to the same program, I'm kind of like, okay, we're siblings. I understand, like, your family. There's that, like, baseline. You know, I found my husband, so, you know, I started dating him at the end of my freshman year. So coming up on 8 years together in April, you know, I did feel like there was some looking out for each other. This ties into something negative, but there was like this whisper network when I was a freshman where the older girls would go and make sure that every freshman knew who was safe and who wasn't. Did it work perfectly? No. But within my first like week, there were all these people, and they made sure that if somebody had been victimized in some way, the victim was never the one telling you, so that everybody's identity was protected. And so it went for like, don't be alone with this, you know, whether it was a professor, or don't be alone with a student. And so there was like this kind of innate protection. I think that fell apart later on. There wasn't as much of a sense of like,
yeah, I was going to say that was a thing too. Mm-hmm. I wasn't aware of it. I heard of it, but the person that was trying to do that to protect others got fired.
Ooh, okay. Yeah. These were all students. I didn't know any professionals who were involved. But even my audition coach, I mean, she wasn't paid by the school. She just had a daughter who went there, like was in on it, was like texting me people. So like there was kind of this whisper network. Seeing how excited people were, Joe and I got engaged on our 4-year dating anniversary. So a few weeks before school, a few weeks into the pandemic, and a few weeks before I finished my degree. And seeing how excited everybody was, and like I texted my teacher, and he texted me a bunch of faculty phone numbers and was like, tell them. Everyone was so, you know, Zoom classes and showing my ring and everything. Like that was really sweet. My wedding, it was a destination wedding, and then it was 2021, October of 2021. So obviously we had to compromise on a lot of stuff. Guest list shrunk way down, COVID restrictions, but I did invite all of my singer friends who, you know, wanted to and who were able to come to sing. We'd learned a song a couple of years ago, and literally I was like, I want to walk down the aisle to this. And it was long. So like the first half was the procession, and then at the like peak of the songs when I came out. For the second half, did not have enough voices. We had to do it with a video, but because we used the video, we used our own recording. So all of my friends who couldn't be there in person, it was like they were there too. And Mark was conducting in that. So Mark was with us in a way. He couldn't be there for the real thing. And I had these people I love and trust so much who all agreed. I felt a little bit bad being like, hey, you guys want to sing for free? But it was a song they'd already learned. So I felt like it was kind of okay to ask that. Didn't have enough voices, so Joe and I had to sing too. So we walked, you know, we started our relationship through singing, and then we walked, you know, I walked down the aisle and singing, and with like the best people I know, the best voices ever. And the fact that my friends were down for it and they wanted to, and it just, it makes me cry to think about like the ways that they were willing to participate in that. So, you know, there were definitely these pockets of positivity. I think a lot of it was formed in fire. There were senses of community. There were teachers who would bring donuts. There were professors who would pay for catering out of their own pockets, who would pay for things that the school wouldn't. Because it's such a small community, it did feel really tight-knit. When it was positive, it could be very good. When it was negative, it was heartbreaking. But I do feel like, you know, I have friends and people just that I respect so much. And I do, yeah, I do have that bond where like, if I meet somebody and they're like, I went to CCPA, I'm like, my family, as long as they're not mean, we are bonded.
Yeah. Yeah. There were a couple stories that were shared to us anonymously, and we're going to kind of talk about those. So one, I will read exactly how it was spoken to me. It says, an example I have with conservatory and classical music culture is just how toxic it can be as far as performance feedback from peers. One specific example is we had a Beethoven Mass in C performance, and there were soloists, and one of the performers, who was a recent CCPA grad, went on to say that some of the soloists should not have been soloists in earshot of the other soloists.
So this made the two soloists very hurt. This person said, my way of interacting with other performers is to be as positive about others' performers as possible. But it's hard to find others who think that way, because even in casual conversations, they'll bring up bad things about other performers in very cruel ways. This story definitely resonates with me, because I had an old friend share with me, this was an incredible violinist. I looked up to her so much, and she was a little bit older than me. So she went to music school before me. And the thing that I really liked about her was not just that she was an amazing like technical player, but she just had the performance. She could give the performance musically. You could see it in her. And that all changed because she had a studio class and the teacher did nothing about it. There were students that were making fun of her for moving too much while she was playing. She performed. And ever since then, she has not been comfortable moving. And she tried to like teach herself to do that again, but she says she can't do it without feeling like shame and embarrassment. So I think that that's another thing when you talk about people that have gotten solos like that and saying, oh, they must not deserve it. That's bringing shame onto them, especially if those people that got the solos are looking up to the other people.
Yeah.
In that kind of similar level, then that's going to hurt a little bit more when it's coming from somebody that you really respect.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Another anonymous story. In a music theory class, the professor was trying to get the class to figure out some aspect of a few bars of music as it related to the form of the piece. It was a Mozart piece, but he wanted a student to explain it. That's pretty standard pedagogy. People understand something better when they can explain it themselves or to someone else. To engage the class, the professor asked what was going on with the motif with a joke, also normal, but the phrasing he chose was, uh-oh, what did Uncle Wolfie do to ya? Don't tell your parents. The meaning was obvious. Mozart had written some clever and or tricky transition slash development in the music, and the professor wanted us to say what it was, but the implication of the joke was that Mozart, Uncle Wolfie, had molested us. And he would have had plausible deniability if not for the don't tell your parents part. That very much implies that it was some kind of child abuse that was being joked about. I remember in real time almost laughing at how bold the first half of the bit was, and then just being shocked when he said the second half of the joke. I remember thinking, there's no way that's what I thought it was, but it must have been inappropriate because it stood out so vividly.
My faith has been destroyed from experiences in my life, but Jesus Christ.
I know. That's, yeah. I can absolutely picture the kind of professor who makes these sorts of jokes.
Previously on Dissonant Dialogue.
Redacted. And it's one of those things where, like, if all of the rest of the culture was positive and somebody made an off-color joke, it would be easy to, like, write it off and be like, okay, that's some dark humor. But then when you know about like the sexual abuse that goes on and, you know, and the grooming and just the emotional abuse in general, like it's one of those things that like you can't look at it isolated anymore. And it's ruined a lot of these interactions and memories I have of kind of those like slightly bold jokes that make you feel like, oh, we're all grown ups and people are being a little bit risque. And then you look back and you go, hold up. No, this is so much more insidious than I thought.
That's the thing about, like, I was talking about being that middle ground where I am a teacher and a student. It's like thinking about some of the jokes that were said to us. Like, could I have ever said that to my students? My adult students. I have students that are minors. I have students that are adults. Could I ever say that to one of my adult students? Never, ever. Ones that are older than me or my age. How could I feel comfortable doing that unless I was being like, unless that felt good to me in some creepy way? It's scary for me to have heard that story now. And the fact that that's joked about, and when you joke about stuff like that from a position of power, it's like enabling it too in some way, and enabling silence of it. I was sent an email from another music student that was sent by her professor, and the context I have is that this was a professor that they had for 3 years, and she was interested in going into a master's degree, and the email's kind of long. But basically, yeah, she reached out and said her interest. She explained it really well, you know, saying like, oh, I'm thinking about where to apply for master's. I really want to do this. And I want your ideas. This is what I want to do. You know, I kind of want to be in like an orchestra of this type. I'm thinking about this, like this type of program. And yeah, the professor came back saying, I can offer you my opinion and advice. The important thing to realize is that the chances of getting a significant orchestra job that pays a decent living wage is slim. I'm sorry to say that, but it's the truth. Some of my best and most talented students have gone years auditioning for the big jobs with no luck. you should really be realistic as to your career goals. Ask yourself, is my level higher than others who are having a very difficult time finding full-time work? Just telling her, like, not even bother trying and go for the smaller level ones. For some of the bigger jobs, you need to have a resume that shows significant orchestral experience even before you'll be invited to audition. I don't think that this particular orchestra would be a significant item on your resume. You're going to need more than that. I heard people compare the odds of getting into a symphony to the odds of getting to the NFL. Do you think you are among the top 30% of violinists in the country? That could be a question to ask yourself and to realistically think about your future. Are you among the top 30% at the school? Yes, you could go to grad school, but you have to be honest. The students who get assistantships are the very best. The competition is extremely high. If you don't get an assistantship, you have to ask yourself, is going to grad school to get an orchestra job even worth it? So you're getting ready to graduate. It would be my hope that now you have gained some sense of where you are with your skills in comparison to the other students who go to school with you. This is what growing up is. Our idealism changes as the realistic future stares at us. Yeah. Oh, that ending was bad. So, I mean, it's okay. Like, yeah, you're trying to let your student know this is a very difficult future. Like, I don't think there's anything wrong with explaining to your students, this is difficult. This is like what it's like. But you also don't shame your students and say, ask yourself, are you really good at your instrument? Like,
I feel like it's so much more than that. Like, first of all, I think what people hear as good is somewhat subjective. I think people decide on different days that some people are good and some people are bad. Some people hear the same performer in two very different ways. A lot of it's who you know, financial opportunities, you know, what you were able to. So I think it's just so much more. It's not as black and white as just, are you good or are you not? And so I would say that so much of it is who you know, where you are, and how other people hear you. And to chalk it up to something of like, oh, you're not getting auditions or you're not, you know, booking gigs because you're not good. I refuse to believe that. I think it's oversaturation in the market, like and fabricated competition. And then connections, just like any other industry. I think really that's what it comes down to.
That's a huge part of it. And then also as a violinist, somebody just performed audition music last week in studio class. And something that the master teacher said was, you know what I think they're going to tell you? They're not even going to, it doesn't matter how good you play, that they're not going to care because you don't have a good enough violin. And it's like something that is the reality, is how people are like, oh, well, if you have a good violin, you're going to sound better, so then we're going to pick you. But what about the people that can't afford a better instrument? So then their skills are just thrown down the drain because they can't afford a better instrument. Like,
barriers to entry is a huge problem in this industry. And it is true that we, as the next generation of musicians, have a responsibility to try and make it better for the next generation of people. Like, we have to do better. So we do have a couple of questions to wrap this up, as it's been quite a long one.
The very first question that we got was advice for those going into music who are worried about conservatory culture. This was a very hard one for me to like think about, because it's like, geez, what can you do when you are not in a position of power to really protect yourself? Like, what can you do to protect yourself when you also can't, by people that have power over you? So I think the number one thing is, for one, listen to this episode. Be aware of what happens behind closed doors. I think being aware of stuff that can happen and frequently happens can protect you from being a victim of certain stuff. Like, when you expect something to happen, it's tad bit easier to kind of protect yourself from it. And I think one of the reasons why we talked about the positives or good memories too is make sure that you do pull positives if you can. If you want to keep your love for music, you almost have to be able to pull some positive out of it. Like, and it's kind of like my life motto is like, despite all the dark stuff that happens, you got to pull positives from it. Otherwise, you just can't survive. So right. I think trying to keep your love for music, you got to pull the good things and you got to kind of sit with those too. If possible, try to have a support system before entering music school. I didn't necessarily have that. And I think that's what made me vulnerable. And that's what made things a little bit harder for me. Yeah. So if you can do that, try to build one, try to have something. Start therapy before you go to music school. Like, honestly, I would say do
that. And continue during if you can.
Yeah, do that. Yeah. And I think a big thing is that, yeah, you have to be really passionate about music, like almost overbearingly passionate about music to make it through music school. So make sure that you are fostering your love for music and making that a priority. Try not to lose that as best as you can.
Yeah.
And lastly, my thing is find a side project, a side hustle, a part-time job if you can fit that in, something so school doesn't consume you. Because for me, school consumed me. I was doing a double degree program and that had entirely consumed me. Yeah, I mean, I was also doing like part-time job at the side, but like 95% of my life was school. And that's what's hard is that I was completely sucked into that culture. It was very difficult. So I think if you have something else too on the side, whether it's music related or not, that
The only things I would add to that is be pleasantly surprised when you get the best, but like expect the worst, be prepared for the worst, keep yourself safe. I would say when it comes to people in positions of authority, be more guarded than you think you need to be. And when it comes to your peers, be less guarded than you think you need to be, because it is so easy to get pulled into that toxic competitive cycle. But those people are you, and you may be working with them for the rest of your life. And so I would say there is nothing as disarming as kindness and vulnerability. A lot of the time, the way we handle it is we're vulnerable to our professors and not at all to our classmates. And I think we need to swap that. I think sometimes if you just go in and say, like, I am here to make friends because I need that for my mental health, you won't have a lot of time for your other friends. I'll tell you that. I wish that I had, a better solution. But it's maybe somebody will laugh at you every once in a while if you say, like, oh, I feel really bad about myself right now. But in my experience, more often than not, when you just sit next to somebody and go, man, I'm really struggling with imposter syndrome today, or man, I don't feel good about this. Like, I don't know how I'm going to get through this. Usually that person, sometimes even the prickliest, most competitive person, will sit there and go, yeah, me too. And that level of honesty is, I think, where so much positive change stems from. I think just taking that moment of like, even if people around you are not willing to rise to the occasion of being as honest as you are, start that trend. Start that trend of vulnerability and honesty, because everyone is faking it. And admitting it does not make you less talented, less valid, or less deserving of your career. Admitting when you're struggling, like maybe other people will think less of you, but it doesn't actually change your ability at all. And there is such strength in taking back the ability to claim your own self-doubt and negative emotions. It takes away the power of it. It feels so big when you can't talk about it. But sometimes when you just admit, yeah, I kind of feel like I suck today, it takes the heaviness out of that, because you never know who's going to sit next to you and go, yep, me too.
Yeah. And then another question is it better for teachers to foster creativity or create competition among students? Oh God, this is a definitely a really heavy one. I mean, for me as a fresh teacher and also a current student, I believe that there is a healthy way to do both. I think we kind of talked about this in our episode about burnout, is that you have to be like overbearingly hard, like that kind of style on your student, or you just have to be this like super easy, like light on your students, can't push them in any way. There are ways to find the middle ground, and don't feel like you're doing the wrong thing unless you're like abusing your students in some way. I think we know not to do, I'm hoping this person knows not to do that. I shouldn't assume that people know not to do that. But don't be so worried about making a mistake that you don't try to really create your own kind of like teacher personality.
That's
And
true.
because I think that's a big thing right now, is that we're seeing the way that students are coming out of really abusive teacher dynamics, and we're like, oh God, I'm so scared of making a mistake. And you got to also like pull back some of that fear.
Here's the other thing. Maybe this is an unpopular opinion. I don't think a teacher needs to create competition. I don't think they need to manufacture it, because it's already there. Exactly. Like, it's already so prevalent. That the best thing you can do is foster the creativity and foster community. Allow them to look at these people as colleagues, as friends. We have this scarcity mindset that there's only so much to go around that only perpetuates that idea. It's almost like the infatuation with breaking down a student's ego when a student's ego was really never a problem to begin with. Like, don't do work that you didn't have to do. You probably don't need to foster competitiveness. You probably need to foster kindness. The last question here, does a student's style play into how they're treated or approached as a music student? I definitely have some experience about that, because when I started school, I was studded necklaces and chokers and, corsets, leather corsets and, split dye hair and some people loved it. Like Mark, my teacher, like he was so complimentary. Did I get crap for it in other aspects? Yeah. Oh, for sure. that's where I think the skin color came into. I think I wouldn't have been perceived as pale as I was if my style hadn't pulled so goth, because people saw that and went, oh, well, obviously your skin is like really white. And sometimes I think, like, if I was dressed like in all pink, would people think that I was as pale as they did? There was a lot, you know, a lot of talk about self-expression and about not being professional or respectable in ways that I don't think we should even factor those things into professional identity. So yeah, it absolutely can. It's not homogenous. People pretend it is. People pretend that everybody has the same standards, and they don't. But I will say that when it comes to your own personal style, you will, in my experience, always have more success in leaning closer to what is authentic to you than what they tell you to do. Because if you copy exactly what you tell them to do, you will lose your confidence. You will lose your spark. And the thing about me is, I'd already gotten into the school by being myself. What they saw when I was myself with my identity made them want me in the school. So I wasn't going to sacrifice that, because I would be a shadow of myself. And eventually I felt confident enough in my own identity and safe enough to be able to tone it down without feeling like I lost myself. But I think ultimately you're not for everybody. So don't be for everybody, you know, be exclusive, be who you actually feel like you are. There are some boundaries, but in terms of your personal self-expression, I think you're going to have more success being authentic and having a few people be pissed off than being fake and being forgettable.
Yeah, totally agree.
The two questions I really wanted to ask was, one, when it comes to, because you're towards the end of at least your first degree, do you feel that despite everything that your degree has prepared you for the next stage of your career to some capacity?
No.
No?
Nope.
That's also how I feel.
I feel like a lot of the stuff I kind of taught myself, you know, we're not taught about the most basic stuff about like marketing, how to like survive financially. Like we're doing these degrees.
Finance.
So we can get a job and do well at the job, but we're not taught how to get the job. We're just taught basic skills that might kind of work for certain jobs. I feel like a huge thing that professors should do is consistently check in with each of your students and be like, what kind of music career do you want? What job do you want to get into? Because there's so many different things. And I feel like we're all being prepared for an orchestral job. And maybe that's not what he wants to do. And I think it's kind of like all the teachers' jobs to kind of tailor towards that as best as they can.
Yeah, for sure.
But yeah, there's a lot of stuff where I'm thinking like, wow, I really like getting ready for student teaching. I'm not really prepared as much as I should be for student teaching. I haven't been prepared by the school as much as I should be for student teaching. A lot of where my preparation has come from is my own teaching experience outside of my school program and conservatory in general. And then in terms of performance stuff, I have zero idea how to audition for an orchestra. And I'm going to be attempting to do that potentially a year from now. I have plans to do that. But we have not been prepared for that. All that matters is get your skills to as high of an orchestral player or soloist level that you can get. And that's kind of it.
Yeah. No, that's the same way I feel. They cut a bunch of courses on business management, you know, that dealt with more of like the finance, like a lot of the courses I was promised just vaporized by the time that I was partway through my degree. They cut our acting courses. They cut our dance course. And obviously we were overworked, but they're just cutting from the wrong areas. So I definitely agree with you in that, like, there's a lot of stuff that I learned just from conversation, but not necessarily, and life experience. And that is part of college. You are going to learn some things that are applicable to you from the life experience rather than the classroom. And that's fair. I'm sort of stuck now. Like, the idea was that you have to do all the extra things in order to get the experience. And with what we pay for education, it should be that you feel at least somewhat prepared to start. Without having done every summer program, done every competition, because it's so much to just fit the requirements. Why can't the requirements prepare you? And then the last question I was going to ask is, was it worth it? That's a heavy one.
That's really heavy for me. I feel like in this world, unfortunately, that we live in, yes, maybe if I went back and had to do it all over again, would I do it all over again? I don't think I would. This is like a very in the moment response, but I don't know that I would
want to do it all over again if I knew the way that things were going to play out from my whole entire conservatory experience. I don't know that I would want to. I feel like I have to say yes, it's worth it because at least I have the degrees that I need to do to get to where I have wanted to go. Yeah, a lot of my passion has been like ripped away and destroyed. Like I'm walking down this pathway and people are like grabbing at me, trying to like destroy my passion as I go down the road. But I've almost technically made it out to the other end, almost enough to where I can still do this thing. Barely. I've been questioning, am I capable of being a teacher? Like, can I actually go in a classroom and do this? Should I get a desk job? Like, I've seriously been questioning that right now because I'm like, I don't know that I can. So yeah, I guess I'm kind of a very like in between on that. Like, if you ask me a year from now, I'll probably have a more definitive answer once I'm like,
Yeah, we'll have to do follow-ups on
yeah,
these.
on that specific question, we really will have to, because I'm wondering a year from now, like, was I able to do it? Was I able to audition for an orchestra? Was I able to, I mean, get a teaching position, but do the job? Can I do it? Can I still practice my instrument? Am I still okay? Like, I don't know that I will be able to right now. I'm kind of in survival mode, just like finish the degrees, finish them, and then we'll reassess when the time comes. So I wonder when I go to reassess what is really going to happen when I start to break that wall down.
I relate to that a lot where there's part of me that like feels like I need to say yes because otherwise it's a betrayal of my childhood self and everything I ever dreamed of. And you're right. Even if you don't feel prepared, the degree is something that is a non-negotiable. You need that to even get your foot in the door. And so I am grateful that I have the degree and I'm proud that I got it despite the fact that it was so hard with my health challenges and just mental health and everything. Like I do like that I can look at that and go, I did it. I did this. No one can take that from me. And I'm not sure I know the full scope of the damage yet, you know? Like it might be, and I'm 4 years out and I'm still not sure. I don't know that it would have been better anywhere else. And I don't know that it would have been worth it for me to find a different career. I don't think I could have lived with myself if I didn't try this. So in that sense, I think it is worth it, but I'm definitely doing damage control. And so yeah, it's a yes and no.
Yeah. Oh, you worded that so well. Yeah, I can relate to everything. I feel like I would have betrayed little me that was like, I did it. I made it into conservatory. Like I'm gonna push through no matter what. Like I just had this like grit and resilience. Like, yeah, I feel like I would have betrayed that little sweet Emily back then.
Yeah, it's like I had to do it,
Yeah.
but now I have to pay for it.
Yeah, exactly. This was a huge one. Yeah. Pretty much bigger than the burnout one, I feel
I
like.
think so.
I'll see how it goes. All right, well, thank you everybody for listening. If you have any feedback, any thoughts, any questions on anything that you've heard today or your own stories that you'd just like to share with us, reach out to us at our email, which is dissonantdialogues@gmail.com, or you can leave us in a voicemail at 872-216-9032 with feedback, thoughts, stories, anything. If you'd like to be a guest potentially on a future podcast episode, if you have topic ideas, questions, give us a follow on Instagram and TikTok, Dissonant Dialogues, and let us know your thoughts and anything that you have.
Take care of yourselves as always, and we'll see you next time. Hi, Kitty.
Holy doll.
Hello. Joe must have heard me say big cat because he just from the other. Yes, there's a cat you can look at. He's 20 pounds.
Oh, Joe.
Joe.
Oh, I love him. That's a good cat.
Happy about it. All right. Are you still sleepy? You slept the whole thing,
Hi,
right?
Casper.
A smile for the picture. But you gotta look at the camera. Okay, let's try again. I think I know how to do it now. Will you focus? Yeah, that as
I have
violent.
no muscle. One. Ah, there you
Really
are.
at seven. Oh, I said it wrong. It was 872. I read the number wrong.